This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The crisis in Ukraine, which began with protests last year, continues to fester, with Russian President Vladimir Putin showing no signs of withdrawing troops from Crimea. The U.S. and its European allies have been meeting this week and agreed to send money to Ukraine and discuss sanctions against Russia. Meanwhile, the Crimean parliament just announced a referendum on March 16th in just 10 days to vote on whether to join the Russian Federation or remain with Ukraine. And this morning, President Obama signed an executive order authorizing sanctions against, quote, individuals and entities responsible for activities undermining democratic processes or institutions in Ukraine. We'll begin with Will Englund. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's based in Moscow. He just got back from Ukraine. And Will Englund, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
How do we determine, or is it possible to determine, who is in control of Crimea today?
Well, I think it's pretty evident that Russia is in control of Crimea. You have these armed men surrounding all the Ukrainian military bases there and blocking the roads and blocking the access to and from Ukraine. And President Putin of Russia claims that they're well-organized local defense militias, but very, very few people, especially including some of my colleagues who've been on the ground in Crimea, believe that. It's very evident that they're Russians. They're driving military vehicles with Russian license plates, for one thing. Some of them have admitted to being Russians, although Putin says that's a provocation. So I think it's pretty evident that Crimea really is fully in Russia's control at this point.
And I guess the fact that the parliament has moved up this referendum, that tells us something, too.
Well, it's interesting that they're in such a rush. Just to back up for a moment, you know, last week the local parliament building was mobbed by a group of unidentified men overnight, and in the morning the members of parliament under occupation voted for a new prime minister, Aksyonov, who runs the sort of pro-Russia party in Crimea. At the last elections he got 4% of the vote, but now he's the top guy there. He's moved up this referendum. In fact, the parliament today voted to join Russia, but it has to be confirmed by referendum. The most likely explanation is that Moscow, Putin, Russia want to create a fact on the ground as quickly as they can before the West or Ukraine can organize resistance. It is, I think, a very small chance that possibly it's Aksyonov who wants to, you know, create a fact on the ground as fast as he possibly can. But it's probably a message coming from Russia.
And Vladimir Putin had a press conference earlier this week. What was your major takeaway from that conference?
Either he has very bad intelligence or he's telling tales. You know, he was talking about in the streets of Kiev. This was, as you said, the day before yesterday. The streets of Kiev are controlled by these mobs of men with ski masks on, and they're beating and torturing pedestrians. And you know, I was in Kiev for the last 2 weeks, and it's simply not true. He's arguing that Ukraine is in complete chaos, and that's certainly the picture of it you get here on Russian television. But for those of us who've been there, you know, it's a fabrication.
Well, and you were there covering the protests. So where has the protest, or where have the protesters gone?
They are, many of them are still exactly where they were in this encampment on the Maidan, which is their name for Independence Square. The interesting thing that one of the challenges that this new government is facing is not only do they have to deal with Russia and the possible secession of Crimea, but the core group of protesters don't really trust them either, sort of from the other side. There's the sense that the new government they were opposition politicians, but they were in the system. And, you know, a lot of people, when you go down to the Maidan, saying, you know, well, this is a revolution. You know, we lost 90 people. We overthrew President Yanukovych, and we want to make sure these guys don't, you know, start playing games as they have so many times in the past. So they're saying, we're going to stay there until we see that we actually have an honest government. It's a tough time for those running the country at the moment.
Well, what would an honest government look like in Ukraine?
Well, All right. I mean, there are seven demands that the people on the Maidan have made, and they're everything from they want to see Yanukovych arrested. Okay, he's in Russia right now. They want to see all the people that they deem to be political prisoners released. I mean, these are concrete steps that can be met. But then, as the list goes on, you're getting into items like, you know, a divorce between business and politics. Well, what they mean by that is, you know, politicians not having their hands in all the largest companies in Ukraine. The situation in Ukraine being very similar to what it is in Russia. But that gets to be, you know, pretty difficult to define. They also, one another demand is independent court system and independent police, which is something Ukraine very much needs. How quickly you can create those is another question. They also want to have what they call lustration, which is essentially identification and purging of any officials, particularly in the courts or police, who played a role in what they believe were Yanukovych's illegal acts over the last several years.
Well, in fact, there was a report this morning on Morning Edition. I don't know if you heard it or not. It was an interview with someone from the Stolen Assets Recovery Program, basically saying that Yanukovych had embezzled something like $37 billion, maybe Yanukovych and some of his allies, $37 billion.
You know, if they could get that money back, that would help Ukraine's economy quite a lot. They figure they need loans of $35 billion to put the government finances on an even keel again.
Well, and there's certainly talk, and I guess it sounds like the U.S. and members of European countries are putting together some money to help Ukraine out. How much does Ukraine need, do you think?
Well, the government says it needs $35 billion in short-term and then some long-term loans. I don't know that there's an IMF team there right now, and they're trying to make an assessment. So that figure may have been more or less plucked out of a hat. The U.S. just promised a $1 billion loan guarantee, and the EU has agreed to $15 billion in loans, assuming that Ukraine can meet IMF requirements, which is going to mean, you know, very stiff austerity in the country. That $15 billion matches what Russia was going to lend to Ukraine under a deal that was struck last fall. So I think that's where that figure comes from. These are short-term things. You know, Ukraine says it needs $20 billion more in long-term loans. I think we'll have a clearer picture in the weeks ahead.
And this is an issue that's been around for a while about whether Ukraine is sort of choosing between Russia and Europe. I realize that's very broad and sort of, you know, black and white way of looking at this crisis. But is there some truth to that?
Yeah, I think there is some truth to that. And I like the way you put it. Ukraine is trying to make this choice. You know, Ukraine isn't a rope in a tug of war between Europe and Russia. You know, it's kind of an internal decision that has to be made, and obviously both Europe and Russia have a keen interest in the outcome and have tried to influence it. That said, Yanukovych was not some sort of Russian puppet. Many people described the divide originally as between pro-European people who wanted a cleaner, more democratic system versus cynics who thought that was impossible. And Yanukovych was, for months, was kind of playing Europe and playing Russia and playing Europe. And clearly his interest was what was best for him. In the end, at the last minute, he backs away from Europe and, you know, tried to sign this deal with Russia. I think it's fair to say Yanukovych was backed by the Kremlin. I don't think it's exactly accurate to say he was pro-Russia.
But that decision, though, sparked the protests that we saw last fall.
The decision to back away from the EU,
yes,
definitely did spark the protest. That was on November 21st. On November 30th, the police waded in onto the Maidan and severely beat up some students. And an awful lot of people have told me that that was kind of the crystallizing moment, that this was about more simply than a trade deal with Europe or whatever. You know, that something was wrong with the system. And it was actually somewhat after that Yanukovych did sign that $15 billion deal with Russia, which now seems to be, in abeyance. Mm. So the protest quickly became anti-Yanukovych rather than, you know, we want to have an opening to Europe.
And how much do you think oil and gas is going to play in resolving this crisis or some kind of resolution to this crisis?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, I guess. One of Russia's real interests in getting Ukraine under its wing is so that it could gain control of the gas pipelines that cross Ukraine and that Russia uses to send gas to natural gas to Europe. Now, Russia has other routes as well, but a lot of it still goes across Ukraine. And if Russia could gain control of that pipeline system, it would control all of the transportation of natural gas to Europe. Now, the EU is at the moment conducting a legal case trying to get the Russian gas company Gazprom to divest itself of other pipelines that feed Europe. They're saying that there has to be you can't have the sort of vertical structure where the gas company also does gas transit. Huh. So that obviously Europe is a lot less interested in seeing Russia controlling Ukrainian gas pipelines. But to get it, the bigger part of your...
Whoops, I think we might have lost our guest. Are you there, Will? No, I heard a little ping, and then he disappeared. That was Will Englund, and I'm sorry we couldn't get... Oh, there we go. I think we have him back. Are you back with us, Will?
I am indeed.
Okay,
yes.
I just heard a little ping. You disappeared, and now you're back. I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your sentence.
Okay, I was just saying, over the longer run, Ukraine is hoping to find alternate sources of natural gas than Russia, but that's not something they can do this year.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, and as you're back in Moscow now, and I'm curious about the kind of news coverage that you're seeing, and there have been some Russian commentators on TV who basically have been criticizing Putin and the Russian government for its actions in Crimea. What do you see when you watch Russian TV?
There are those people, you're right, but you don't see very many of them. Mostly you see what I would have to characterize as hysterical coverage of mobs of Nazis, you know, running free all around Ukraine, beating up little old ladies, and especially beating up Russian-speaking people, which is, again, really a complete fabrication. It's not true, but that's the picture that's being presented here.
And is that the picture? I mean, is it the same picture that people see over and over and over again?
Yeah, that's been a consistent theme here. I mean, of course, I was in Ukraine for the last week, but from what I understand and from what I've been able to see of Russian television, it's been a theme ever since Yanukovych fled, yes.
Well, Will Englund, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's based in Moscow and just got back from Ukraine, and we're going to continue our conversation. We have two guests waiting in the wings, and we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. The crisis in Ukraine. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's only concerto for the violin is as much about the orchestra as it is the soloist. The Philadelphia Orchestra is joined by Nikolai Schneider for Beethoven's Violin Concerto. Also, Stefan Denev conducts Shostakovich's 10th Symphony. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999 today, this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Nikolai Schneider and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the Lost Region. One historian says the Midwest is being forgotten when it comes to American history.
There are no institutions that study the history of the Midwest. There's no Midwestern Studies Association. There's no journal that focuses on the Midwest.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about the crisis in Ukraine. And joining us now are Corey Welt. He's Associate Research Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University, also an adjunct fellow at the Center for American Progress. Corey Welt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
Also with us is Julia Yaffe, and she's a senior editor at The New Republic, previously was a Moscow-based correspondent for foreign policy in The New Yorker. And Julia Yaffe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
Julia, let me begin with you and ask a sort of basic question here. What does Vladimir Putin want?
You know, I think past the annexation of the Crimea, which he's wanted since at least 2008, he made that clear in at the Russia NATO summit in Bucharest, Romania, in 2008. He said that if NATO took Ukraine, then he would take Crimea. So he's had his sights on that island peninsula for a long time. What happens next is unclear. There was news yesterday that this was kind of a last minute decision for the Kremlin. It's not clear that he knows kind of the long-term, that he has a long-term strategy here. He's traditionally been quite a short-term tactical rather than strategic thinker, and I don't know that he's decided yet whether he's going to stop at Crimea or try to bite off a chunk of eastern or southern Ukraine. I think only time will tell.
But does he want Ukraine because he wants to rebuild, you know, what was the Soviet Union?
I don't think he thinks he's rebuilding anything. You know, at that same summit in Bucharest in April 2008, he told George W. Bush, who was, you know, then American president, said, you know, George, what is Ukraine really? It's not a real country. Part of it is the West, and part of it was, and a big part of it was just given to them by us. So it's not that he's rebuilding anything. He thinks he's taking what's naturally his and Russia's. He doesn't even think Ukraine is an actual country.
Corey, well, let me get you in on the conversation. How do you understand what Vladimir Putin is doing?
Sure. I mean, I agree that he probably doesn't have much of a long-term strategy, and unfortunately, when the Russian government decides to make certain steps that might not even be in their best interest, it's also difficult for them to climb back down. I also think the swiftness with which the operations in Crimea took place seemed to suggest that there was at least a plan on the shelf ready to be invoked if a change like this happened in Kiev. Whether or not he's trying to rebuild some kind of new post-Soviet, neo-Soviet empire is sort of besides the point. I think at the very least, what the Russian government saw with the change in power in Kiev is the very real possibility of losing Kiev, even though many in the West haven't seen this as a zero-sum game, but losing Kiev, Ukraine as a whole to Europe and the West. And this kind of move is an effort to prevent that from happening, to promote uncertainty and instability in Ukraine, and at the very least, if nothing else succeeds, then to be able to take at least the part of Ukraine that most Russians feel is most strongly about.
Julie, it's so interesting because, you know, we were just watching the Sochi Olympics not so many days ago, which was, of course, celebrating, you know, all things Russia, and there was Putin sitting in the stands and I guess, you know, enjoying the spectacle, and now he's in the middle of a crisis. Does he see it that way?
I don't know that he sees it as a crisis. He seems kind of puzzled and I don't know if puzzled is the right word, but kind of bemused by Western reaction. Again, he thinks he's taking what's already his, and he I think actually the Olympics do have a lot to do with it. You know, he was riding really high afterwards. It went off basically without a hitch. It was a beautiful opening and closing ceremonies. Russia won in the medals count, which was very important given how badly they did in the previous Winter Olympics at Vancouver. And I think there was, I don't know if we want to really psychoanalyze him, but I think there was like a bit of adrenaline coming
to his head.
Olympics.
Went to his head.
I don't know. I also agree that it wasn't entirely a last minute decision. If you look at the equipment, the, you know, quote unquote non-Russian troops have in Crimea, they have these brand new uniforms without insignia that are clearly Russian uniforms designed by the Russian designer Valentin Yudashkin. You know, that had to have you know, that takes some logistical preparation to get the weaponry and to get the weapon, the uniforms with that insignia to the soldiers. You know, like it was clearly not totally last minute.
Corey, well, let me go back to you, and I'm curious about sort of how the Budapest non-interference agreement, how does that play into this? And this was something that Russia signed on to.
Sure, in exchange for Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons, signing the non-proliferation treaty, Russia and the United States, together with the United Kingdom, had agreed that they would commit to not using force against Ukraine, respecting its territorial integrity, and so forth. So it's not a treaty, but it was an international agreement that, if you believe in those sorts of things, ought to have been respected. And clearly, what's happened is a violation in terms of responses, and what it commits the United States and the UK to do is to consult with Ukraine in the event of a violation of the agreement. It was clear from the very start that this wasn't a NATO-like commitment to defend Ukraine. Ukrainian government at the time understood that. All parties understood that. What President Putin is trying to do now in a not very convincing manner is to suggest that with the change in government in Kiev, what is happening now is a revolution and has meant that there's an entirely new Ukrainian state that's being built, which the Russian government did not sign an agreement with. It's a ridiculous claim, frankly, I just don't think a document like this would really be sufficient to prevent Russia from acting if it deemed it necessary.
Go ahead, Julia. Go ahead.
Sorry to cut in. You know, it's interesting the kind of the doublespeak we hear coming out of Moscow. On one hand, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, refuses to speak to his Ukrainian counterpart in Paris. And Vladimir Putin says that he doesn't have anybody to talk to in Ukraine because whoever is the president now is illegitimate. On the other hand, the Crimean parliament, which this morning voted to add a question onto the referendum and add a question onto it that would basically annex itself to Russia. I don't even know if they had a quorum. They just didn't invite the deputies they knew wouldn't vote for it. The mayor of Sevastopol, who was just elected by a square in the crowd, those are all seem to be legitimate and fine. It's this very kind of I don't know, picking and choosing that it's kind of funny to even have to explain it. It's like I don't know, the hypocrisy there is so obvious. As for abiding by treaties and respecting certain documents, this reminds me of when I just got to Moscow as a correspondent. It was back in 2010. There was a big scandal around Daimler Chrysler, which was found under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act here in the U.S., was found to have been paying massive kickbacks to the Kremlin presidential administration in order to outfit the presidential fleet of cars. And there was a whole indictment, a massive document from the DOJ that they handed over to the Russians. And then President Dmitry Medvedev said, you know, this is only a document in your country.
And I'm asking you to obviously get inside of people's heads. That's Julia Yaffe, senior editor at The New Republic. As she said, was a Moscow-based correspondent for foreign policy and The New Yorker. Corey Welt with us, associate research professor of international affairs at George Washington University. He's also an adjunct fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we are talking what many people are talking about today, the crisis in Ukraine. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Corey, I just have a question to you, and Julia, I'd like your response as well, and then we will get to our callers. American officials have been meeting with their European counterparts, talking about freezing assets, travel bans, the possibility of sanctions, treating Russia as a kind of a pariah state. Do you think, Corey, any of those will be effective in getting Russia to back down?
There's also a question
of
what
the intent.
What the intent of the sanctions is. The administration said that there would be costs if Russia moved forward with this, and it is going to keep to its word. There's very broad bipartisan support for the actions that the president made today in announcing visa bans and preparations for asset freezes for those involved in these operations. They don't advertise the individuals' names for visa bans, and maybe they will be able to when it comes to asset freezes.
Right.
But they're moving forward. It's a good question whether these kinds of sanctions will scare the Russian government into backing off in Crimea. I think that we've seen certainly some signs of moderation on the part of the Russian government in the last few days in terms of at least trying to signal that it has limited goals. The problem is that those goals are still unacceptable to most everyone outside. Mm-hmm. And if they continue to go forward with accepting a referendum in Crimea and then accepting the results, if those results are for independence, then I think it's practically inevitable that we'll see greater steps at isolation of Russia, and that's the choice that the West is trying to give to Putin right now. But unfortunately, I'm not terribly optimistic that these sanctions alone will encourage a change in course. But just to conclude, we do have a few more days for diplomacy to work. There needs to be a much greater focus on trying to access the officials in Crimea, broader representation of the local parliament in Crimea, and try to get them to change the terms, to delay, to postpone. It's not going to be good for anyone if they move forward with this referendum.
Julia, you've written a lot about Vladimir Putin, and one of the things that you said about him, Putin's logic, that it's better to be feared than loved. And if we're talking about this crisis and the standoff and whether Crimea votes to go with the Russian Federation or not, if he would rather be feared than loved, is there any way to resolve this crisis?
You know, I fear not. That's kind of what I think is the question that's facing the U.S. right now, is whether we want to punish Russia or give them an off-ramp to dissolve this crisis. Punishment, you know, will only nip them a little bit. You'd really need Europe to sign on to any economic sanctions for Russia to really feel the hurt, and so far they've been reluctant to do that. The reason is that the elites have a lot of money and real estate in Europe, especially, and in Cyprus. Their children live there, their wives live there, and you know, if Europe were to institute a travel ban or an asset freeze, then that would really hurt. That said, I don't know that it would really change anything, because Putin has shown, he's shown in 2008 when he invaded Georgia, that he's willing to take quite a lot of economic pain to achieve these kinds of larger geopolitical goals or, in his mind, reputational historical goals. He, especially in the last 2 years since he's come back to the presidency officially, he's, you know, we hear a lot of Cold War rhetoric. I would blame Putin first and foremost for initiating that and ratcheting that up. It's been this anti-Americanism, anti-Western sentiment that's running at an incredible high in Russia right now. It's kind of terrifying. It's been the kind of, the unofficial ideology of his third term. It's his claim. It's the way he's legitimized his return to power. It's this return to this classic image of Russia beset by enemies, besieged by enemies. And the more we punish them, the more it plays into it and gives him a firmer hand at home.
So kind of a fear and paranoia, it sounds like you're describing. Let me get Dale from Lindenburg to join us on Radio Times. Dale, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You're
great
welcome.
Show. I want to say first that I don't think there's any angels here at all, that I'm not a big Putin fan at all, but I think we need some perspective here, and I want to ask the question, can we really, really blame Russia for reacting like this when, remember, not so long ago in the Olympics, we had that phone call intercepted from our Undersecretary of State, Nuland, basically saying, we want Yats in. Yats is our guy. Well, now Yats, whatever his real name is now the premier or boss man of the Ukraine. So we've kind of got our hand-picked guy in there. We've overthrown, granted, a very corrupt but democratically elected regime in there. So it's kind of a little hard to take hearing Kerry crowing about international law and righteousness when it's only been 11 years since Iraq.
Well, Dale, you put a lot of stuff on the table. Julia, go ahead, and Corey, I'd like to hear from you as well. Go ahead, Julia.
You know, there's a couple things to say there. First of all, it's actually been amazing to see how little influence America has had on the ground in Ukraine. Russia has had far more influence there, and still, my impression from being in Kiev and in the east of Ukraine was that this was almost entirely an internal process, and that if anybody was trying to tip the scales from the outside, it was Russia. The U.S., as usual, was playing catch-up and trying to kind of slap together an ad hoc policy for what to do. I wouldn't say that Yatsenyuk is a hand-picked American guy. He's been around Ukrainian politics for a long time. The other thing is that, sure, you know, we could. Everybody, there are no angels here, and we can talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. But I don't know. Maybe Corey can weigh in here.
Yeah. Let me take one of Dale's questions, and I'll toss this to you, Corey, which is and this is something that Putin has talked about, which is raising questions about the ouster of Yanukovych and whether, you know, he was democratically elected. And yes, there was certainly violence in the streets, but whether that was the reason was reason enough to boot him from power.
Yeah, I mean, first, let me just say there's a high bar for military intervention, and there's almost an insurmountable bar to justify military interventions designed to annex parts of neighboring countries. So regardless of whatever Russian concerns it might be about U.S. foreign policy in Ukraine, there's just a million other ways to address the issues in ways that are generally accepted. So it's very difficult to justify these actions on the part of U.S. policy. You asked the question of whether
Yanukovych was sort of, you know, illegally booted from power.
His impeachment was supported by over three quarters of the Ukrainian parliament. It showed broad support among even members of his, or at least former members of the ruling party. There was mass defections in the days before and discussed with his use of lethal violence against protesters in support of his removal. If you look at it constitutionally, they didn't follow the rules by the letter. That is clear. But again, it's a political crisis, and there's a process that's been underway in Kiev and in negotiations with regions of Ukraine on how to move forward to a fully legitimate, democratically elected government. And everybody practically is on board in that process, except for those that are controlling the situation in Crimea.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again, talking about the crisis in Ukraine. And our guests are Corey Welt, Julia Yaffe, and we have a lot of callers that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. How do you think this is going to end? Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, Philadelphia, supports WHYY and presents Open House March 15th and 16th. The fully accredited professional program curriculum comes to life during live model painting demonstrations by award-winning instructors, private tours of on-site studios, time to talk with students, instructors, and alumni who are working in the arts, and information about the new integrated art studio major available with Chestnut Hill College. StudioIncaminati.org.
Truth and justice, not necessarily the American way.
You see how people get caught in the system. And part of it is, I think, our adversarial system, which is not necessarily about truth. It's about, you know, winning or losing.
Filmmaker Alex Gibney examines the lost and found people in America's death row prisons. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from Widener University. Widener University offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University is hosting a graduate open house on March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. That's March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration is available now at widener.edu/leadership. That's widener.edu/leadership. Widener Leadership works.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Julia Yaffe, senior editor at The New Republic, and Corey Welt from George Washington University and the Center for American Progress. We are talking about the crisis in Ukraine, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Julia wanted to say something right before the break, before I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Sorry. What I wanted to add was that in addition to the fact that it's been amazing the kind of orderliness and lawfulness with which the transition has happened and how it's immediately gone to the parliament and things have been voted kind of very swiftly through parliament, which has been amazing, and no violence after the revolution. Secondly, Yanukovych fled. You know, he wasn't really toppled. He fled. And about the Victoria Nuland call and what we saw yesterday with the leak to Russia Today of the call between the Estonian foreign minister and Catherine Ashton, I would ask about why these leaks are happening to begin with. Mm. You know, like the Russian special services are tapping phones of diplomats, which, okay, I assume they're doing, but constantly leaking them to prove points. It's really crass, I have to say, especially the leak yesterday was about the two of them discussing claims that there were claims going around the day that there was shooting that the snipers were hired by the opposition as a provocation. This was one of the many theories floating around that day. And it was leaked by the Russians the day after Vladimir Putin in his press conference made that very kind of conspiratorial allegation. It's just a bizarre and kind of, you know, unsportsmanlike way to go about things.
Corey, there was a story this morning on a morning edition about Yanukovych and something like and some of his, I guess, friends or allies embezzling state funds. This came from the Stolen Asset Recovery Program. Something like $37 billion of missing assets. It's sort of hard to imagine how that is even possible, but also a state funds that were used to build this insanely lavish mansion for him. I mean, just how much government corruption has there been in Ukraine?
I don't know about $37 billion, clearly there are signs, and there's been indications for a long time, of massive government corruption. The pace at which Yanukovych, members of his family, those around him, accumulated vast amounts of wealth in a very short period of time, there's really only one way to do that, not a legal way. So this is something that has been going on for a long time. There weren't any surprises about it. And you're right. Frankly, if it was $37 billion, then everyone should be supporting the Ukrainian authorities on how to recover a lot of that money in order to pay their debts and to support them.
One thing I wanted to say about Yanukovych as well is a couple days after he fled and after the government changed hands in Kiev, I went to Donetsk, which is his hometown, and was the place where his party, the Party of the Regions, was founded. It was amazing how unpopular he was and how unpopular his party was. And it wasn't because the new government in Kiev was popular, but because he had fled. And when we talk about, when I hear claims about Yanukovych being toppled unlawfully, etc., that was not at all the impression, even in his base. His base came to hate him very quickly because he fled.
Mm. And I want to. You have a piece in the New Republic I want to ask you about. But let me get. Looks like Karen from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I've been over to Russia quite in the past 3 years, teaching law to Russian lawyers. So I have a lot of friends over there. And my main concern, to try to be brief, is media coverage here. Number one, demonization of Russia, which I'm really seeing too much of, and that goes on all the time, but particularly now we're kind of being whipped up into a frenzy over here, as they are there. And but number two, what I'm really concerned about is a lot of the frenzy being whipped up in Russia are allegations about a lot of different things that our media are just ignoring. And I'll give you an example. There are a lot of examples, but in the past 24 hours, for example, Russian media reporting about a recording they keep playing by Catherine Ashton, about the snipers in Maidan were really hired by the protesters. Okay, this may or may not be rank false propaganda, but the point is, Russians are hearing it. A lot of Americans who pay attention are hearing these things, plus the allegations of Nazis and right-wingers and Maidan protesters. None of this may be true. Some of it may be true. But our media are just sticking to a party line, just like the Russian media are.
Well, Karen,
not addressing it.
Well, let me take your point. And actually, let me give Corey a chance to respond to that. I mean, we could do a whole hour on media coverage. But do you think in this country, Corey, that the public is being whipped up by the media on this issue?
I don't think they're being whipped up by it. I'm sure that Julie will have a lot to say about this. I mean, clearly, there's many people in the media don't pass up an opportunity to be critical of Russia and the Russian government. It's an easy target. There's a lot of more attention perhaps paid on problematic actions that Russia takes than on the actions of other countries. But in terms of the kinds of things that the caller has raised, I mean, I'm all for full, complete investigations. Sure. We should be calling under normal circumstances, not under a time of military occupation, but under normal circumstances for full investigations of all allegations in order to discover the truth. That's fine, but once again, the response of the Russian government in this case has been so disproportionate that it makes it very difficult to address some of the very real issues and very real concerns that Ukrainians themselves have.
Do you think the media, this is, of course, speaking very broadly, Julia, is missing some of the stories or seeing it in much too much sort of black and white terms?
I think there are going to be stories that fall through the cracks, in part because the story is moving so quickly. And I think that's just, and a lot of people here just don't have an expertise in the region. As for the black and whiteness and Russia being an easy target, yeah, it's an easy target, but it sure provides us a lot of ammunition, let's be honest. I mean, I've been trying to get off the Russia beat for the last year and a half since I moved back. It's proved absolutely impossible because every day, or, you know, at least once a month, there's something. You know, Russia passes a bill banning gay propaganda, or Russia tries to annex a part of a sovereign country. Let's be honest, like, there are things that the U.S. media is missing, but let's talk about how the Russian media is covering this, or how Russia Today, which is a propaganda outlet funded entirely by the Kremlin to kind of try to give us the Russian point of view, is covering things. They, in complete alliance with what the Russian defense minister is saying. Russia Today yesterday had a whole segment about how this is not really an invasion because no shots have been fired. Mm. And it's just the Western media that's whipping up a frenzy that this is not really an invasion. I don't know. If we talk about black and white, I think it's pretty clear what sending in troops in uniform with the latest guns into the territory of a sovereign country is, other than an invasion. I think that there are certain things here that are very clear, and we shouldn't let the Russians muddy the waters, because they're doing it in their, there is no free media there anymore, and they're doing it in their own national interests. As for the allegations about the snipers, if you listen to the call, they're just discussing claims. The day that the shooting broke out in Kiev, there were a lot of rumors flying around. It was not clear who was shooting whom. There were snipers on both sides, but there were lots of wild rumors floating around. The Russians love a good conspiracy theory, and the Ukrainians do too. Ashton and the Estonian foreign minister were discussing these claims, and they themselves didn't know whether it was true. The Russians have leaked this audio and are now saying it's proof that the opposition did hire the snipers, whereas if you listen to the call, they're saying, did you hear about these rumors? That's it.
Let me get, looks like Paul from Hamilton, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I think it would have been derelict if Vladimir Putin and the Russians did not secure their naval base. And I think that's what this is all about. Russia, I think, has been very reasonable in restraining their use of power and violence, unlike the mob that had an illegal coup that took over the Ukrainian government that is running it now. Remember, the Ukrainian government was not elected. It was taken over by a mob of violent street criminals who threw Molotov cocktails at police, and that's all. You can see it at liveleak.com, and to watch the videos of the behavior of these mobs. And so Russia has been using absolute restraint, and they have historic rights to their naval base in on the Crimean peninsula.
Well, so Paul, do they have a historic right to what happens in Kiev? Is it not their business what happens in Kiev? And also, what about every single member of the Rada who was elected and who voted to impeach Viktor Yanukovych? Is everything that's happened in the legally, lawfully elected Rada since, is that a coup?
I would just say this, and I would remind ourselves, we're Americans. This is very far away for us. This is not our hemisphere region of the world. And
Russia has the right to its
Monroe Doctrine to be the major power in their hemisphere. And I think
is it their
Americans
business what happens in Kiev?
Okay, fair. You know what? Let me give Corey, fair enough, both to you, Paul, and to you, Julia, but let me give you, Corey, a chance to weigh in to Paul's comments.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's crazy to invoke a Monroe Doctrine. We don't have a Monroe Doctrine now. There's no historical rights that Russia has to Crimea. The Black Sea Fleet is stationing by virtue of a bilateral agreement between two sovereign states. Ukraine has the right, if it wanted to remove the Black Sea Fleet. But frankly, the important part of this question is that Russia has the opportunity and really the burden of proof to demonstrate that that's all this is about. If that's the case, then it just has to come out more strongly than it has that the Russian government would have no intention of recognizing a referendum that supported the independence of Crimea, because that's not what it's about. And to date, they haven't said that. And unfortunately, they're following the playbook that they followed elsewhere, which is to allow the Crimean people, quote-unquote, to choose their own political course, and after that, they'll likely strive to legitimize it. And that's unfortunate, and if that happens, that would demonstrate that what the caller is saying is just not true.
Julia, let me ask you something. Your latest piece in the New Republic about what seems like a kind of a generational split within Ukraine about its future. How should we understand, I guess, how divided this country is about what the next move should be?
I think the larger point of the piece is that all of this, what's happening now, is just part of this long post-Soviet transition, and I think that's how it's going to be seen by historians however many years on. I talk to people in Donetsk and southeastern Ukraine, which is kind of the Russian the heartland there in Ukraine, and it seemed that there was research to support this, that younger people, even if they were ethnic Russians and primarily Russian speakers, tended to see themselves as Ukrainian, mostly because they were born into an independent Ukraine and had a notion of citizenship that was tied to the country where they were born. The generation of their parents and grandparents, however, tended to see themselves as Russian, which I argue is the terms Russian and Soviet for them have roughly equal meanings, because the Soviet Union, as it was cobbled together by Stalin in the early 20s, became a distinctively Russian entity despite all of the ethnic minorities and ethnic and national republics that were kind of under its umbrella. It was still a very, very much a Russian entity, and I think that for many in that generation, there's a certain interchangeability of those two words.
We only have a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye. Corey, I just wanted to quote something that Hillary Clinton said earlier this week. She was at I'm not sure if it was a fundraiser or some kind of a meeting earlier this week, and she said about this crisis, now if this sounds familiar, it's what Hitler did back in the 1930s. They're not being treated right. I must go in and protect my people, and that's what's gotten everyone so nervous. She wasn't saying, of course, you know, that this is Nazi Germany in the 1930s, but she was raising a concern about, I guess, this desire to so-called protect people, that could be an excuse, I guess, for Putin and the Russians to go into a place like Crimea.
Yeah, well, she allegedly said it, right? This is a
I'm looking at a quote here, but yes, allegedly
quoted her as saying, perhaps she did, but it wasn't on the record, and it wasn't a public. It wasn't on the record. I think the bottom line is that most people in the world recognize that that you don't use military force to annex parts of neighboring countries, and you don't invoke false claims of the need to defend ethnic kin, and you don't start offering population citizenship with the pretense of then being able to come in and defend them militarily. So these kinds of justifications, it's worrisome that they're being used. It's worrisome that many Russians seem to think that this is a legitimate use of force, but it's something that I think is roundly rejected by most people and most nations around the world.
Julia, there's this referendum set for March 16th. We're almost out of time here, but do you have a sense about how people will be voting?
I have no idea. I haven't been to Crimea or kind of done the groundwork there, or the legwork. But I have to agree that, you know, this is Putin's been looking for an excuse for a long time to take Crimea. As I said, he floated the idea even back in April 2008, 6 years ago. So this thing about needing to protect our Slavic brothers is, I don't know, very hard to believe.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. Julia Yaffe, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior editor at the New Republic, Corey Welt, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And he's with the, associate professor of international affairs at George Washington University and an adjunct fellow at the Center for American Progress. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Twitter, Facebook, email, archives. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.